How are we doing? Good, excellent, eh? So it's real cool to be part of this But God series. When the elders first put it out, Genesis 41, which I'm going to speak on today, wasn't actually part of the initial program. But I had been, I won't go into the story why, I was listening to a sermon on it about the time that the series was put together, and from a pastor in Auckland. And as he was talking on Genesis 41 and just going through the story, I don't know whether you get this feeling sometimes, but you just feel like that God is all over it, and this is kind of a word for us in this season. And so I ask for this to be included in the But God series. And, you know, we are, and I know it's been said on numerous occasions, hasn't it, that we are in unprecedented times. And as soon as I say that, most of us will think about COVID, and that's true. I mean, COVID has had a huge impact on us. It's having a big impact on us politically. It's testing our political boundaries, isn't it? Socially, economically, it's having a massive impact in those areas. But for me, there's, and this is just how I feel about it, there's actually bigger things happening in our society, in our communities. You know, one of the things that has really been hitting me lately with the community workers and just what we're hearing about in the community. And I know this has been around for a while, but over the last few weeks, maybe 2-3 months, this has just become so prevalent. We're hearing about it more and more. And that's these kids, and I say kids because we're talking about 10 to 14 year olds, are getting high on drugs. And this is normal in our community around us. And the interesting thing, well, not the interesting thing, probably the saddest thing about this is that these drugs are being given to them, primarily marijuana, are being given to them by their parents, by their aunts and uncles, by their guardians. Those people who should be looking after them are actually feeding them this stuff in order to just cope with life. And that is coming at us. You know, it's here. And there was a lot of talk about marijuana being made legal, and of course it's not yet, but there's an inevitability about it, in my view, because just in society at the moment, it's just becoming so normal. It's just becoming the way, you know, like people having a drink. But also what we're finding, and I heard an article, a news article, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago. Yeah, and part of this, the reason that they're thinking of making or trying to make MDMA legal, and this is the reason, because the effects are generally not life-threatening and would not therefore lead the user to seek out emergency care. So that's the rationale behind it, because it's not going to cause people to wind up in our emergency departments. And they're thinking, well, it's got to be okay if it's not causing that degree of harm. And so there is a push at the moment to make that legal. We've got that coming at us. It's right here. It's right now. I don't know how else to describe it, but I think we would, we are in a, what I can only describe it as what I think is a sexual revolution. We have people who are born males who can just decide that they are female. We have people who are born female that can just decide that they are male. We have 70 to 80 different genders in whoever made that up, but that's the way that people are being categorised at the moment. And there is this whole area of gender that's called non-binary, where you're neither male or female. And wrong piece of paper. But the interesting thing about that is just that, it was an article I was reading, if I can find my little bit of paper. It talked about how people's gender fluctuates over time. So that's what this article was talking about, how people's gender fluctuates over time. So people can just kind of move in and out of male, female. But this is here. This is in our society now. And then we have a whole lot of stuff around mental health, don't we? And family breakdown. There's lots of things we could look at in order to just look at our society. And what's really been striking me lately is this is coming at us in New Zealand like a freight train. In many respects, it's here, but it's the full impact of it, we still haven't seen it, but it's coming. And the question is, as a church, what do we do? What do we do when our culture at the moment is becoming so secularized? How are we going to cope with that? What are we processing, or how are we processing that, and how are we going to engage? See, as Christians, we can have a number of options, can't we? And I'm sure there's more than I'm just going to throw out now. But the three options that I was thinking about is, one, we can disengage. We can actually kind of hide and withdraw and just kind of say, well, that's society out there, and we're going to lock ourselves in our church building or in our home, and we are going to shelter ourselves from this train that is coming. The problem with that is when we look at the life of Jesus, he was with the sinners and the prostitutes. He was with the tax collectors. That's where he spent his time. He was engaging with the authorities and the political level. He was engaging with the religious leaders of today, of his day. He wasn't locking himself away, but he was engaging with the society. And so, you know, churches can kind of go the Amish or exclusive brethren way, where we just want to shut this out. But that is not what God calls the church to do. Now, the other way that we can approach it is that we can simply become like the culture. And we can see that in churches today, can't we? Just becoming like the culture, embracing the whole LGBT philosophy, and just kind of rolling with it. But in order to roll with it, in order to do that, we have to stop believing this and taking this Bible as our authority. And we cannot do that. God's authority doesn't change because we decide that it's going to change. The Bible is our authority, and we hold to that authority. And I know we do in this church. And so we can't take this approach of just becoming like the culture. The other way that I think a lot of people are thinking about our culture at the moment is we're looking to politics. We're looking to the politicians to make the right decisions and right changes in order to kind of realign us as a society. But the problem, the interesting thing about that is in John chapter 6, the people wanted to make Jesus king. And what did Jesus do? He fled from it. He didn't want to be a political figure. And we know in John chapter 18, where Jesus was being arrested by the Jews, by the Romans, sorry, and old Peter got his sword out and started to defend Jesus. And in that, a little bit later on in that chapter, when Jesus was talking to Pilate about it, he said this. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews." That's what Jesus said. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I would not be delivered to the Jews. John 18:36. You see, we can kind of look to politics as our solution to our secular culture that is coming at us like a freight train. Now, the reason that I want us to look at Genesis chapter 41 is because we see in Genesis chapter 41 not necessarily all of the answers to these really complex questions, but I think what we see is we see in Joseph a pattern of engagement that we need to take stock of and actually look at. You see, as we had heard this morning, I mean, Joseph, his father was Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons, and they became the 12 tribes of Israel, roughly. And we'll look at that a little bit later if I get there. But Joseph was the second to youngest son, and his brothers hated him. And they hated him to the degree that they wanted to murder him, kill him, get rid of him. But instead of doing that, they decided to sell him as a slave to Egypt. A slave, he was taken as a slave into a society that was totally secular. It was fully secular. There was nothing of Yahweh there. They worshipped foreign gods. In fact, if we read over a little bit further, I might read it just in Genesis 43, verse 32, it says how the Egyptians would not eat with the Hebrews, for they were an abomination to the Egyptians. They were like, that word abomination means they were disgusting, they were and detestable, particularly in a moral sense. So he was going into a culture which was fully antagonistic, is that the right word? That'll do. Towards him. And so he was going into this culture where his God wasn't recognized. Nothing about who he was recognized, and everything that was recognized about him was detestable to the Egyptians. And the cool thing about the story is that Joseph didn't just survive, he thrived. He didn't just survive, he thrived. And I think there are some lessons that we can take from the way that he lived that can help us to engage with our culture, our secular culture, in a meaningful way. And so as we heard in the story that Joseph himself told this morning, he was in that situation where sold as a slave into Potiphar's, he was in Potiphar's house, falsely accused of a crime, put in prison, then where he met the baker and the cupbearer of Pharaoh, who had also been put into prison. They had dreams. Joseph interpreted them. He made right interpretations where the cupbearer was put to death, and the baker was put to death, and the cupbearer was reinstated. And then we pick up chapter 41, where it says, after 2 whole years, so after 2 years of that event, this is what happens. And we know Pharaoh, it says, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and behold, there came up out of the Nile 7 cows, attractive and plump, and they fed in the reed grass. And behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly cows, thin, and the ugly thin cows ate up the 7 attractive plump cows, and Pharaoh awoke. And he fell asleep again and dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on one stalk. And behold, after them sprouted 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. So in the morning, his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my offenses today, when Pharaoh was angry with his servant and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with his own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving the interpretation of each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about, I was restored to my office and the baker was hanged. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you, when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not me, but God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. I just want to stop there for a second. Try and get the picture here. This is incredible. This guy, Joseph, he's 30 now, and he was 17 when he was taken slave. So he's been in Egypt for 13 years. He gets the opportunity right now to stand before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh has a request from him. And do you know the first thing he does? He testifies to the greatness of God. The first words that come out of his mouth. To the one in whom his hand is life and death. To whether he goes back to prison or not is in Pharaoh's hand. And the very first thing he says, he doesn't say, oh yeah, I can interpret dreams, send them my way. The first thing he says is, I cannot interpret dreams, but my God can. You see, if we're going to survive in a secular society, we have to have a bold testimony that we live for God. We cannot hide it. We cannot be ashamed of it. And we have to stand before whoever we stand before, and be able to declare a testimony of who our God is. We overcome the enemy by what? The blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony, loving not our life to death. And this is what Joseph was doing. His life was literally in Pharaoh's hands. He could have just said, you're a Hebrew. I hate Hebrews. What are you going to do talking about your God? He could have just cut his head off there and then. I don't think we can miss the magnitude of what happened there. The very first words out of his mouth is, my God lives, and he will give you the interpretation. We have to hold our testimony, the power of our testimony. You know, some of you will know this story, just really briefly, and there's so much to it. But I really encourage you to go and talk to our son, Aaron, about his barbershop and how that came into being. And the whole idea that he was a barber at a shop in town, and he would often have conversations with people about God. Just, you know, they'd ask him what he did at the weekend and say, I went to church. And just natural, casual conversations. And anyway, after he'd been there for maybe, I don't know, might have been a couple of years, the boss came to him, called him out and said, you have to stop talking about God or you'll lose your job. And he stood there, and God had prepared him for this, and you ask him the story, but God had prepared him for this, and he stood there And he said, I really like my job. I really like working here. But if it's between God and my job, I will leave. And that night, God gave him a dream and showed him about starting his own barbershop. He hadn't even finished his apprenticeship yet. And in that dream, it was very detailed, even to the point of where his shop was going to be. And he woke up in the morning and he said to me, Dad, I had a dream and I saw where my shop was on Broadway. I said, do you think you can go and look and see if it's there? He said, I can. It was that accurate. He went and he drove there and the shop was for lease in the exact spot that he had his dream. But he didn't know what was going to happen. That might not have been his testimony. His testimony might have been that he got fired. And he's been in that shop now for 4 or 5 years. You see, we have to hold our testimony. We have to be confident that our God saves and he rules and he reigns. And Joseph was confident in that. And we see as the conversation continues, Pharaoh repeats the dream. So we'll pick it up at verse 25. And the conversation continues. And this is, again, the first time, the second time that Joseph speaks to Pharaoh. Then Joseph said, verse 25, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. He is declaring that God is in this. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one, and the 7 lean and ugly cows that came out after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty years blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh, God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. God has shown Pharaoh. He just continues to testify to Pharaoh in a very natural, respectful way that God is in this and his God will sort it out. And he goes on and he says, wherever I was up to, the famine will consume the land, verse 31, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by the reason of the famine that will follow. For it will be very severe, and the doubting and the doubling of Pharaoh's dreams means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will surely bring it about. He just kept talking about his God is in control. His God is doing this. His God rules and reigns. And he can just kept declaring who God was. See, as Christians, we can often take a step back, can't we? We can often, yes, I believe in God, but I'm not confident enough, or I'm not bold enough to proclaim and declare. And yet, if we are going to survive in this secular society, we have got to be bold enough to proclaim and declare. In Acts chapter 4, when the apostles had come under their first real bout of persecution after they'd preached the gospel at Pentecost, many, many people had been saved. And the authorities arrested them, commanded them not to preach. And the first thing they did after that, they got released, they got let out. The first thing they did is they went to prayer and prayed to God for boldness to stand and to proclaim in that secular setting. The power of prayer to pray for boldness, to pray that we would not shrink back, that we would not withdraw our testimony at the threat of secularism, but that we would stand true to who Christ has called us to be. You know, we are working more and more with the house next door, with secular organisations, and God is just so speaking to me about this. He's saying, Andrew, just keep standing for me. Keep declaring who I am. And if we don't get their finances, that's fine. If we don't get their support, that's fine. But in a respectful way, declare that Jesus is Lord. And God rules and reigns. If we lose our testimony, we lose everything. We overcome through the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony. And it may mean people will lose their jobs, lose their positions. It may mean that things won't always go well. But it didn't always go well for Joseph either, as he stood for God. But often we will hide because we don't want to rattle the cages. And we want to stay safe in this community, and safe in our secularization. But we can't stay safe. We have to be bold. We have to stand up. And we have to start saying and declaring who Christ is in a way that we have never done before. Verse 33. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed and appoint overseers over the land, and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years, and let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it, that the food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through famine. Sonia was reading this morning, and she asked me, she said, just reading through the passage, and she said, how did Joseph know to set aside 20%? How did he know? Like, if you know the story, you think he would have had to set aside a lot more than 20%. 7 years of prosperity, and then 7 years of extreme famine. Is 20% enough? In my head, it's not, because they didn't just feed Egypt. They fed all the surrounding area. You know, the thing is that Joseph obviously had a relationship with God. We're in this setting, God had given him wisdom. See, just recently we've done a bit of a series at Commissioned, and we talked about the difference between the word of knowledge and the word of wisdom. You see, the thing about knowledge, God had given Joseph the knowledge of what was to come. He'd given Pharaoh the knowledge of what was to come. 7 good years followed by 7 tough years. But then, here's the thing, he knew what to do with that knowledge, and that is wisdom. God had given him the wisdom of understanding of what needed to be done. And this is a really important thing if we're going to survive in our secular society, is we have got to start operating in the wisdom of God. You see, because so often Christians can have knowledge, but the way we use that knowledge is not always wise. Our knowledge might be good, but that doesn't mean the way that we use it is good. I mean, I was thinking about this, and I don't know the man, and I'm not going to. I'm just making a comment of you know, Israel Folau and everything that went on with him. So he had knowledge, and his knowledge was right. But I wonder, and it's only my wonderings, whether he, what he needed in that case was God's wisdom and how to declare what he was trying to declare. Because instead of actually it being a positive testimony for God, maybe it wasn't as positive as it could be. I'm trying to be careful in what I say because I don't know the man and I don't know his motive. And I'm not even trying to make a judgment on him, but I just wanted to pull that out, the difference between knowledge and wisdom. You know, many of us have knowledge many of us think we have knowledge about COVID and what it is or what it isn't. We think we have knowledge about the vaccines of what it is and what it isn't. And that's fine. No problems with that. What we need to be so careful of is that we are using the knowledge that we have in wisdom. You know, when Peter pulled out his sword, he had knowledge that Jesus was going to be arrested. And he was ready to defend. But he didn't have wisdom. Jesus said, put your sword away. You don't know what is about to happen. You don't understand my kingdom. You don't understand what I'm called to. And so often as Christians, we can even operate out of, we can operate out of even theological knowledge in a way that is so damaging. Where we're cutting each other apart with our knowledge. Where we are burning bridges in our communities because of our knowledge. Because we're not seeking the counsel of God in wisdom. What psalm did you read at prayer, Sonia, this morning? I was meant to ask it earlier. She doesn't remember one of them. But it talked about how David... 27, because it talked about how David delighted to inquire of the Lord. He delighted to inquire of the Lord, to seek the Lord's wisdom. Prayer on his face before God. We've got to be praying, church, if we want to operate in wisdom, if we want to be able to stand in the secular society, we have got to be operating not just out of knowledge but out of wisdom, and the only place we get that wisdom from is God, and the only way we get that is through prayer and intimacy with Him. Well, the time is, but everybody that's online can just turn me off, so that's cool. Genesis, so we're still in verse 37. This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? This is so cool. It's like Joseph is saying, this is what you need, but he wasn't pointing to himself at all. He was saying, this is who you need. You need a person of wisdom, and this is what they need to do. There's nothing in the passage where Joseph was putting his hand up and saying, pick me. He was just saying, Pharaoh, this is what you need to do. And then Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You should be over my house, and all the people shall... over my house and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set over you all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from from his hand and put it in Joseph's hand and clothed him in the garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in his second chariot, and they called out to him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name. That's a good one. Zaphnath, that'll do. Peneath, that'll do. And he gave him in marriage to Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. Like, this is incredible, the authority that is given to Joseph. Now, the interesting thing about this is lots of people, when they read the story of Joseph, we look at this and we think, this is kind of the pinnacle of the story, because Joseph has gone from prison to palace in the matter of hours, from a slave to a prisoner, to second in command over Egypt, this massive country, and Pharaoh is saying, no one shall even move a hand or a foot without your command. That's obviously a bit of exaggeration, but you know what he's saying, the authority. He was given such authority, but he was given power, he was given wealth, he was given honor, he was given status, his clothes were changed, he was given a gold signet around his neck, he was riding around in this flash chariot, and people had to were called to bow before him. This is crazy. And we can look at this and we can say, man, what do we get out of this? What is the lesson that God is trying to teach us here? Because a lot of people pull this out, and I think very wrongly, and they say, you know, here's the story of Joseph, and what it's saying is, if you just be faithful to God, eventually you'll get to this place of prosperity and power, and God will make you succeed. And lots of people look at the story of Joseph, and they kind of say that, you know, if you're faithful to God, it'll be all right. Your life will turn out really nice in the end. Well, we know that's not true, don't we? Because we know, I've just been doing a study on the life of Jeremiah. Whoa. Every bit as faithful as Joseph. 40 years proclaimed the word of God to the nation of Israel. Faithfully. Hated by his family. Hated by those in his hometown. He was the religious authorities, as well as the kings, were against him, trying to kill him regularly. For 40 years, eventually he was exiled to Egypt, carried off by his own people to Egypt. He didn't want to go, but they were saying, no, you're coming, you're getting out of Jerusalem. And we don't know. He continued to prophesy, and we don't know what actually happened to Jeremiah from a biblical perspective, but history tells us that he probably died in Egypt at the hands of his own people. And he was faithful. You know, this is not about prosperity. This is not about success. This is about God positioning his people to do his work in his way at his time. Jeremiah did it, and Joseph did it. So what can we learn from this passage here? Well, you know what? We want to know how to engage with our culture, with our secular culture. When I read this, this is a little bit mind-blowing, actually, because the first thing that, that Pharaoh does is he dresses him differently. He dresses him like an Egyptian. He puts the Egyptian garb on him. And then he changes his name. He says, you are no longer Joseph, but you are now, I'm giving you an Egyptian name, this other name, that long one. And then he gives him a wife, an Egyptian wife. And says, now this is your wife. Now I think this is really interesting for us to think about. Why didn't Joseph say to Pharaoh, no way, Jose. My name is Joseph. It will always be Joseph. That is my God-given name. Why didn't he say, I'm not wearing that Egyptian garb. I don't want to look like an Egyptian. I'm a Hebrew. Egyptians hate Hebrews. I don't want to look like one of you guys. And why did he say, there's no way I am marrying an Egyptian wife. No way, Jose. Think he was scared to say that? I don't think so. He just stood in front of Pharaoh and declared God in front of him, putting his life on the line. He wasn't scared of dying. Do you know why he did that? Because he needed to engage in the culture in order to do what God had called him to do. He needed to engage in the culture to do what God had called him to do. He wasn't compromising who he was, but he was going as far as he could to become part of the culture. When his brothers came to eventually when his brothers arrived, and we won't look at it, but when his brothers arrived, they didn't recognize him. I mean, Joseph knew who they were. Why didn't they recognize him? He looked like an Egyptian. He talked like an Egyptian. He needed a translator. He was using a translator. It says in the scriptures, he was using a translator to talk to them. He was speaking, it's not Egyptian, I don't know what it is. Whatever they were speaking, Coptic, I think I looked it up. He was speaking their language. He looked like them, he spoke like them, he thought like them. But he maintained his position in God. You see, so often we are so afraid of culture. We can get, I mean, churches are noted for being about 50 years behind culture. Because we kind of identify old culture with godliness for some reason. I don't understand it, but we kind of get used to something, and God may have done great things in that culture, and so we think that we have to stay there in order for God to continue to do great things. And then the culture that we live in is moving on, and then what happens? We're like left behind. See, if people are offended by me, by us as a church, do you know what I want them to be offended about? Only one thing, the gospel. If they're going to be offended and not be here, the only reason I want them walking out the door is because they're offended by the gospel. Not because our cultural traditions are so foreign to them that they have no idea what we're about. And that's what Joseph was doing. He was making sure that he looked Egyptian, that he spoke Egyptian, because when he gave the commands, the respect was there for him to be received. He didn't want to make it more difficult than it needed to be. And so often we're scared of engaging with the culture because we think we might be contaminated by it, and we can be contaminated by it if we take it too far. But the culture itself is not, it's neutral. And we need to be able to engage with it in order to be a witness for Christ. The interesting thing about this is we know that Joseph, the interesting thing about Joseph and his whole story, if you read his whole story as second to Pharaoh, he didn't use his political power to try and enforce God's ways upon the nation. They never changed. Egypt was Egypt before and after he had been around. He wasn't looking at his political position as a way to enforce his principles, his godly principles on the nation. He just served Pharaoh in the way that Pharaoh had asked him to serve him, and he did a great job. He just served Pharaoh. So why did God have him there? What was the purpose? Well, the purpose was to provide a space for the people of God to come into and to thrive and prosper. His whole family eventually came to Egypt, secular culture. But because of Joseph's political positioning, he was able to provide a space in that nation for his people, the people of Israel, God's people, to prosper. And that was why he was there. You see, and I think that when we think about politics and when we think about how to engage with politics in our secular society, growing secular society, so many of us are looking to the politicians. Oh, we just need more Christian laws and more things that are going to pull everybody in line. Now, I don't object to that, but at the end of the day, that is not going to happen at the moment, because that's not the way the political system is working. We have voted in the people that we have voted in as a society, and they are not godly, they are secular. That is what we have. So what's our role in that? It is to those who are engaging in the political system, it is to find and make sure that space is open for the church, the kingdom of God, to prosper. And I think if we can see politics that way, not that we're trying to change the nation, the only way we change the nation is by the gospel. People's lives changed through Christ, that our testimony stands. And see, the thing is that, and this is so cool, this is such a cool part of the story that I'm going to finish off, is that 7 years, like after, Joseph had two sons. Before the famine came, during the years of plenty, Joseph had two sons. And he named them Hebrew names. He named them Hebrew names. It says in verse 51, Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. God has made me forget all the hard stuff, all the difficult stuff, and he was giving praise to God through the naming of his kids. And then the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. He was still in the land of his affliction. He was still in the land of his affliction. Egypt was the land of his affliction. Because when Joseph died, what was his request? That his bones would be taken to the promised land. And we read, when we read in the great hall of faith in Hebrews, what is Joseph noted for? That his bones, asking that his bones be taken back to his land. He never lost his hope in God and who God was, what he was going to do, not just through his life, but through his people. See, I look at things like the house next door and I see that and I think, this is not about what happens in the next 5 or 10 years even. This is about what God is going to do in the Roslyn community, even in the generations to come. We have to be able to think much bigger than just what we are here doing now. We're just part of a small part of God's amazing plan. Father, I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for your word. I want to thank you for the story of Joseph. And I just pray that you will take this and help each one of us to learn how to engage better in the secular culture that is coming at us like a freight train. I thank you, Lord, that you are in control. Just as you were in control in Egypt, you are in control in New Zealand. You are on the throne. Your plans prevail. But you have got this challenge for your church at the moment, and you are asking us to arise in your spirit, in your empowering, in your wisdom, with your testimony in our mouth. Lord, I just pray that you will help us do that well. To stand for you and bring your name glory in this nation at this time. In Jesus' name we pray.